The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
Hello, I'm Becky Annison, and welcome to this episode of The Hearing. Today, we will be looking at the philosophical underbelly of the legal profession in the West, some of the assumptions it is based on, and what that means for our practice. But in particular, we're going to be talking about how our current way of thinking might not be enough when it comes to discharging our duties as human beings and tackling the large and multifaceted crises we have today in the modern world.
Hi, I'm Ryan Rod James. I'm a regenerative business evolutionary, the co-founder of Rebiz, a business as usual unschool, and the co-founder of Repurposed Law.
I'm Janeta Sedilakova. I'm a practicing climate and biodiversity risk lawyer. I'm a director of a climate and biodiversity risk consultancy firm called Planet Law Lab and a co-founder of Repurpose Law.
The Hearing.
Thank you so much for coming to talk to me today, Janeta and Ryan. I'm really interested to hear more about what you're doing because I think it could be something that's really interesting to our listeners. Can you just describe for me, what is Repurpose Law?
Repurpose Law is a 5-week personal and professional development learning journey for lawyers that helps to connect them with different worldviews and mindsets that are going to enable them to create futures that are in harmony with all of life. So my background personally is rooted in learning and traveling and being mentored from various different Indigenous elders and teachers from around the world for about a decade. And we highlight and focus on something called two-eyed seeing, which takes Western intelligences and sciences and ways of knowing, and also takes Indigenous sciences and ways of knowing, and connects both of them together, not alienating either one of them, but taking both of them into consideration to make decisions about how to move forward in a way that is holistic and interconnected. Another key point to know here about Repurposed Law is that since Janeta and I, neither one of us are Indigenous people, we work with and are advised by multiple different elders from different communities from around the world. And our project is what we consider a project rooted in allyship. So how do we actually be a bridge for these knowledges and ways of knowing to come into the world, and for these voices and perspectives to be represented in a lot of the work that we're doing so that we can actually create methodologies and frameworks for advancing into the future that are socially and ecologically just.
So lawyers in the West, I think we know that we have a particular training, a particular culture and mindset, and which I assume that we're probably so steeped in, we don't even realize it most of the time. And so given the work you've done, I would be really interested if you could reflect back to us, what are the key elements of the mindset that we're not seeing? How might they be holding us back?
Yeah, it's a really important question. The way that one of my teachers says what you just stated is, he always asks me, if you were to ask a fish about the water, would the fish know what you're talking about? So a lot of times we don't recognize the mindset that we're in. And the way that we position this within Repurposed Law is actually that the mind is set in something. So actually, we need to take a step back into a worldview. Because oftentimes we can change the way that we're attempting to look at the world, but if the way that we're looking in the world is concretized in a specific orientation, then it doesn't matter how many times you move the lens, the way that the lens is pointing is never going to expose the perspectives that you want to bring to the light. So one of the things that is a very clear-cut one from where we're sitting is anthropocentrism. So the perspective and mindset that everything needs to be optimized and created specifically for human beings. This is a really important one to look at because from the technologies that we implement to the way that we create the law and interpret the law, it's fine to interpret it from a human lens, but ultimately we have to understand that we are nested within environments that also have layers of understanding and layers of agency that human beings are set within. For example, the economy is set within nature. Nature is not set within the economy. So anthropocentrism is the continual viewpoint that the world is here for us exclusively as humans, and we get to do whatever we want with everything else because we're the ones who are at the top of the food chain. Therefore, everything else can just kowtow to us. Anthropocentrism is one of these mindsets. The second one that we see a lot is mechanistic or reductionistic mindset, meaning if you utilize this much carbon, you can plant this many trees. Something like this one-for-one trading is not how nature works, because nature works in multi-generational, multi-species ecosystems where everything has to function within one another, and they all have their specific functions. So if you're cutting down an old-growth forest and then replanting a mono tree forest, that's not the same. Yeah, there's a lot more things that are involved in that. There's a lot more diversity that needs to be taken into consideration. So we can't reduce, hence the word reductionistic, nature into this machine-like quality where we can just swap things on a spreadsheet and expect them to actually create the same ecosystems that we have been deteriorating with our continued development of the world. And the one more that I want to highlight before I hand it off to Jeanette for her to share what she thinks on this subject too is there's a very linear perspective. Linear can be interpreted a couple different ways, but right now we think that time started with the Big Bang and then came the Stone Age, Egypt, iPhone, apocalypse. Like we're moving in this line across time. And therefore everything that we need to progress exists in the future state that isn't already here. So an indigenous way of thinking is a non-linear way of thinking. And the best way that I can describe this is that a quote from Robin Wall Kimmerer. And she says, if time is a line and the future lies in this state where all of our answers are, then of course we're going to have to find them in some different place than where we already are. But if time is a circle, then all of the answers already exist within, and we just have to remember how to apply the things that are already here into a way of enabling more life. So that would be a more nonlinear perspective of this, is that nature, it could also be called a biomimetic perspective. Nature already has some of the most complex patterns and solutions about how to create resilient, adaptable life that enables regenerative things to thrive. Yet if we're trying to discover something that we think already isn't here, then we stop looking at nature, which I think is one of the most brilliantly engineered systems that we could ever ask. We sprung from it, right? So it's kind of a little bit arrogant too to think that we're going to, even though we sprung from nature, that we're going to find some answer that nature doesn't already have, even though we are emerging from that space. So I just want to highlight those three: anthropocentric, mechanistic, and reductionistic, and linear. And then see if Jeanette has anything to add to those.
I would just relate it more to law and give you a particular example of how what has Ryan described as the principles of the mindset and worldview that we have in the West can manifest in the way we do law. And I want to focus on the concept of ownership. So in our course, Repurpose Law, there is one whole chapter on ownership, Western principle of ownership, and then how we have learned from different advisors that we have interviewed for the course, how ownership functions in an indigenous perspective or from an indigenous perspective. And to give you a sense of how profound this is, when we were on a call with one of our advisors, Kumu from Hawaii, and we asked him a question, how do people from your cultural tradition understand ownership? He told us that our entire question was wrong. He said ownership is a Western way of relating to the world around us. people in the West, in your cultural tradition, think that humans own everything around them through variety of leases or outright ownership, depending in which particular legal system you are in. Our way of relating to the world around us is different. So your question should be not starting at the basis of ownership, at the default of ownership, but it should be above it. And you should ask, how do people in your cultural tradition relate to the world around them? So even, you know, when Ryan said the fish wouldn't see the water around it, we don't see ownership around us as an assumption. For us, it's a norm, but it's just an assumption because there is a different way of relating to the world around you. And there are different complexities to it, depending in which indigenous culture you are. But the word that summarizes the principles how indigenous people around the world relate to the world around them is stewardship. Stewardship as a responsibility to take care of their land that takes care of you in reciprocity for your care. And then obviously from stewardship, sprang different types of principles that you use. Reciprocity, I have mentioned, is one of them. Mutuality, another. Gratitude as well. You would say it's not a legal principle, but through the interviews and analysis we have done, gratitude can be considered as one of the legal principles in these traditions, indigenous traditions. And as such, it's a completely different model from ownership, because ownership is inherently hierarchical. It's us owning everything we have. And therefore, ownership confers on you the right to destroy. You can destroy what you own, and that's actually not a property damage under any legal system. Whereas stewardship is non-hierarchical. You are at the same level of relationality with the world around you as anything else. You don't own anything. One of our advisors even expressed it more beautifully when he said, "The land doesn't belong to me. I belong to the land." And that is even more profound idea of the fact that the entire body you have has been put together from the fruits that the land has provided, and therefore you belong to that land rather than that land belonging to you through the legal concept of ownership.
Yeah, beautifully said. And exactly what Janetta just highlighted would be the difference between an anthropocentric view, meaning I own the land, versus a kinship view or a relational view, which is I belong with this land. So, and I just want to add one more thing in here that to kind of show a little bit more why these perspectives are really important. I believe it was the 2019 IPCC report. The year might be one year off, but they stated that 80% of the world's biodiversity is stewarded by 5% of the world's population. That world's population, the 5%, is original peoples or indigenous peoples. So that means that those 5% of people who are stewarding that 80% of the world's biodiversity know something that we could learn from. And instead of thinking conceptually that what they know is just this idea, in fact, what this is, it's a way of living that they have then conceptualized into specific worldviews and cultures that are embedded within the bioregional areas that they live, so much so that they become keystone species in those areas and enable more life to thrive within them. So by looking at that statistic alone and looking at the progression of where we're moving within business and law, which is to steward and work with biodiversity and nature and provide nature with rights and all of these sort of things that law is moving towards, we need to learn from the people who have been doing this for thousands and thousands of years already.
Interesting. Do you mind if I ask you to just explain for the listeners what a keystone species is? Because I think it's a concept which is quite dearly tied to ecology, and which is one that lawyers may not have come across before.
Sure. So a keystone species is a species that has a disproportionately large effect on its natural environment relative to its thriving and to its abundance. So right now, the Merriam-Webster definition of nature in the dictionary is anywhere that humans are not, essentially. So what a keystone species is sitting in the nexus point of the creation of the regenerative environment, rather than needing to step out of it to enable nature to thrive. So the main difference in that is that wherever humans are is destructive, right? That's a specific view that we have right now about human beings. And like, well, just leave that land alone, because if we go there, we're just going to mess it all up. Versus, oh, if we go to this land and actually learn to listen and to act in accordance with natural law, then we will actually enable more life to thrive in that area. So a keystone species has more of that view. And a lot of the original peoples on the North American continent and all over the world have always been a keystone species, utilizing things such as fire ecology and various other methodologies of enhancing the land's biodiversity. And essentially what this is, if you want to label it, is biocultural heritage instead of biodiversity. So biodiversity looks specifically at the land, but biocultural heritage looks at the biodiversity of the land in relation to the diversity of the culture that thrives in reciprocity with that land itself, so that the culture actually holds a specific key within listening to and then applying what they understand about the land to enable it to create more abundance.
I just want to add that examples of keystone species, as Ryan said, some of the indigenous cultures would have been keystone species. There are other animals, other species that are considered keystone species. And in the UK, for example, beavers have been, and to the extent they have been reintroduced, are considered keystone species. They're also sometimes called ecosystem engineers, the idea being that they engineer these dams and therefore move water courses and enable the water to transgress in a landscape in a way that divides the landscape and therefore creates life for other species to thrive as well.
Interesting. I'm going to move on now. I think we've covered a lot of the major differences between Western legal training and Indigenous thought in my first question in your very excellent answers. But is there anything else that you feel like we've missed? Is there another kind of really fundamental difference? We've talked about linear versus non-linearity, ownership versus stewardship. Is there another kind of foundational difference that you think it would be useful for lawyers to hear about?
Yes. So from the research, I have come to understand an overarching principle in these legal traditions as being one of relationality. And that's the one I would highlight. And I mentioned it before, but not in such a prominent space. So when we're comparing the Western legal concepts to Indigenous legal concepts, we realize that a lot of Western legal concepts are transactional. It's an exchange, and often exchange of money. Indigenous legal concepts are relational. And relationality means when you have a dispute resolution, if you go through your trial, traditionally called in Western legal system, it's not about winners and losers. It's about preserving a relationship between the parties and the relationship within the community. So if all of a sudden you move from a transaction to relationship, your entire decision-making process within communities or companies changes. Your approach to dispute resolution changes from adversarial, winners and losers, to very much community-based restoration of relationship, also called restorative justice. Also employed in countries with indigenous populations such as Canada. And your entire approach also to land, to ownership, changes from ownership to stewardship, which is relational. You are in a relationship to the land and you take care of it in reciprocity for the land taking care of you. So relationality as an overarching principle is probably the most important one I would highlight.
Did you have anything you wanted to add to that, Brian?
The word relationality can also be interpreted in the word of kinship. So in the same way that Jeanette is talking about this relationality and the deep importance of maintaining a social fabric that's going to be able to navigate various different storms that continually happen in reality, part of that is to also, which we're seeing right now in a lot of these movements, right, is to give nature rights. So kinship can be viewed as a level of understanding that what we call nature or what we call the climate or what we call any of these things is an interconnected substrate of various different lives that have agency, that have story, that have the ability to self-regulate, and also which we could call have consciousness. You know, trees, for example, communicate, but they don't communicate like humans do. Now, we might view a tree as less intelligent because it doesn't speak English, but who is going to actually be able to navigate the changes in the climate easier, trees or humans? Right? So to understand a level of kinship, we have to also understand how to learn with these things in nature. And the rights of nature is a good step in that direction. But one of the things that one of my teachers always asks me is he says, if we're giving nature the same rights that we give humans, look how we treat humans who have rights. You know, so all of a sudden, just because we give nature rights, is that going to change the way that we treat nature? Because look at what we do with people who have rights. So there's something else that's amiss in there. Although the step is in the right direction, there's something to look at about what we even view a right to be. And where is the place where a right becomes a responsibility and the responsibility becomes a privilege, which relates to the Hawaiian term of kuleana, which is the privilege of the gift of life in so much so as to create a responsibility to take care of life. So to understand that kinship and this relationality, not only from the anthropocentric perspective, but how we can enable environments to thrive, which naturally will help us to thrive alongside and within them, is an important thing that we can fit into these movements like rights of nature and the continual legal structures that are created to preserve and take care of life.
Becky, I would add one thing there to kuleana, because when I was learning about kuleana, we find it very valuable to explain it to our cohort participants as it's translated into English as privilege and responsibility as two words, one words in pre-colonial Hawaii, native Hawaii language. And we realize that if it's one word, you have a privilege to own land, and then you have a corresponding responsibility to share the fruits of that land with your neighbors. And if you divide the two words into privilege and responsibility in English, it's very easy to divide them in practice, to separate them in practice. And what we have seen in our legal system is a separation. For example, in corporate law, privilege to extract and profit given to corporations and responsibility to remedy the harm which has resulted from that extraction and in that profit to citizens and governments. And this is, in repurpose law, we also look at linguistic perspectives, because obviously language is such a profound basis of law. And we explore these ideas of when you separate concepts in law and in language, you do separate them in practice. And kuleana is a great example.
The hearing. On the outside, you're a lawyer, calm and cool. But inside, there's a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. You prepare hour after hour, day after day, in the pursuit of excellence, relying on superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence. That's the advantage we give you. Be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes, every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
You've laid out some really, really interesting differences between how some Indigenous peoples approach concepts and how we in the Western legal tradition approach them. And I can see lots and lots of answers to this question, but I want to hear your answers, which is, why is this important for lawyers in the time that we're currently living in?
So from my perspective, this is important for lawyers because as people and as a profession, as a legal profession, we have lost our purpose. And that's why we call it repurpose law, because there used to be a purpose in law and how it is practiced. And that has been lost throughout hundreds of years of the way law has been practiced. So when we started putting the course together, we actually asked the fundamental question, which is, what is the purpose of law? And what we meant by it wasn't history of law. It wasn't, you know, Hammurabi code. It wasn't going all the way back to first legal text written in stone. It was genuinely, why do we people need law? And orangutans or gorillas don't. Why do we have law? Where did it come from? And we went down all the way to our evolution, all the way to the moment we came down from trees somewhere in Africa. And we found that purpose of law to be to serve and to care. And you have been a practicing commercial solicitor. You know how it works. The way we practice law today is far removed from serving and caring. So repurposing law through reconnecting to these profound ideas from a different worldview, from that indigenous worldview, and bringing some of them into the way we practice currently in the Western legal systems can help you find your purpose in the world, which is facing unprecedented changes. And that's really profound because in that world, there is a mindset we have been implementing in law, the mindset of perpetual continuous growth, which has brought us into this situation of climate change, biodiversity loss, plastic pollution. I like to call all these issues a planetary crisis because there are so many of them. All of them relate to our relationship to our planet. And that mindset that has brought us into the crisis cannot single-handedly get us out of that crisis, help us address that crisis. And that is why we need to look beyond what we know, beyond ownership, beyond transactional relationships, beyond adversarial dispute resolution, and look at how it could be done differently. And these different ways of thinking, conceptualizing, and problem solving are at the core of repurpose law and at the core of how lawyers can connect back to their purpose as lawyers.
That's very interesting. I'm casting my mind back as you're talking because I took legal philosophy on my law degree. Well over 20 years ago now, so how relevant it is, who even knows? But as you were talking, I was thinking, you know, what I remember from my legal philosophy, that part of my degree, was that there was a big debate between natural law, which is that law is given to us by God, and legal positivism, which is that law is created by man. And I always remember kind of thinking to myself, well, I think it's almost something in between. It's not that law is created by God solely and law is created by man, but we have evolved laws because if you have a law that says don't murder people, that's an important law that you need to have in order for a society to basically be functional and survive. That was kind of my interpretation of kind of a middle ground between the two, is that the reason that some systems kind of coalesce around don't murder people, don't steal things, that sort of thing, is because in order for a society to function, there's some basic things, some basic hygiene, I suppose, in terms of what law needs to be. And what you're sort of saying is that at some way or along the line, that got distorted, and the basic function of that has become distorted, and now we're in a real mess. So then I'm going to ask my really, really hard question, which I think is something I grapple with all the time, which is that I understand that many of the Western approaches are not integrating humanity and the environment that we live in, or even humans in between, you know, the relationships between humans, and they're not foregrounding that, and that as various different planetary crises encroach, the effects of that are potentially becoming more obvious. However, we live in a society right now which is absolutely dominated by capitalism, by profitable growth, by shareholdings, and, you know, all of the mechanisms of the economy, the global economy that we have built as humans, and they have a very, very strong grip on our culture, but they have an incredibly strong grip on our legal system and our lawyers, you know. So my question is, I love the idea of having a more relational approach, but how do I take that into a boardroom? How do I talk to C-suite and say things in a way which is meaningful, which is going to be heard, which is going to be beneficial to them and their business? How would you answer that question?
So there is a process to it, and not every part of the process will be most suitable for each boardroom, but we will give you the process so that the listeners and you yourself, Becky, can pick from that process. So in the course, in Repurpose Law Course, we introduce people, as I said, we introduce lawyers to different ways of thinking, conceptualizing, and problem solving. And some of them are extremely powerful. And our most favorite one is a trickster paradigm. So across indigenous cultures around the world, there is this character of a trickster. And in some, trickster takes a shape of an animal, a very smart, cunning animal like coyote or raven in North America. In some other cultures, it's a semigod. But across all cultures, trickster is this extremely intelligent being that plays tricks with you. But the reason that the trickster does it is to show you where you are not looking. It's to alert you to the places you have missed because you have been in this rat race, let's say, or you have been doing things in a routine way for so long that you have forgotten that it can be done differently. And oftentimes trickster, you know, I have come to conceptualize trickster as a good friend who has been whispering to you for a long time that there are certain things you are doing which are self-destructive. And you haven't listened. You have been ignoring those whispers. So he starts playing tricks with you. And through those tricks, although they seem, you know, unloving and unkind, they're actually trying to pull you out of that self-destruction into new ways of thinking or living. In Western thought, trickster is probably closest to something we called reversed thinking. And reverse thinking is essentially an idea that you take a concept and you flip it. And when you flip it, you realize the other end of a scale of solutions. However, those are two extremes. And all the solutions will lie in between the two extremes. And I can give you two examples. One is from my practical consultancy practice, and then one is legal. So the practical one, I was a couple of months ago approached by a client who was figuring out their supply chains. They asked me a question, you know we are transitioning to net zero by 2050. We know some of our supply chains are not going to survive the transition. And right now we have this massive question, which is which of them will and which of them will not, and therefore how do we invest our money consciously and responsibly in 2024? So I took the concept of supply chains and I said to them, you know, supply chains are a manifestation of a phenomenon of globalization. Now, globalization is a one end of your scale. Now flip it through reverse thinking and you get localization, right? You don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that the opposite of globalization is localization. Those are your two extremes. Some supply chains are globalized, some will be localized. However, the solutions oftentimes do not lie at the edges, at the extremes. It's not a binary problem solving. It's a continuum. And then I started asking trickster questions. And this is where trickster comes in. And this is where I like to say reverse thinking gets you to the extremes. Reverse thinking gets you to the binary. And trickster will introduce you to the multiplicity of solutions in between. So I started asking questions such as, okay, imagine a particular supply chain of yours was disturbed. What would happen, right? Trickster, essentially COVID-19 can be seen as a trickster. It would be disturbed. What would happen? Would your customers suffer? Would they not be able to sort alternatives locally? Because if the answer is no, then you could be oversaturating an already saturated market in the economy, which does not need your product. And because we know that carbon is going to be priced in your goods and supply chains are quite carbon intensive, those products will probably become prohibitively expensive anyways in a couple of years. Example of soaps, right? Imagine a client supplying US soaps to the UK. If that supply chain is cut, Will UK people smell? No, they'll just get their local soaps, right? So that supply chain could be quite redundant. And that supply chain is something that you should probably phase out. Imagine a supply chain of argan oil, which comes from Morocco and is much harder to produce locally. Is that supply chain going to be needed? You have to ask questions about the needs of the people that you are supplying to. The fact that we are going from the wants economy to the needs economy is a huge part of the equation as well. But all these trickster questions will tell my client and help them identify which of the supply chains are redundant and probably likely to be phased out, and which of them are going to be strengthened or shortened. Can you localize your global supply chain? And that was the trickster. That's what trickster allowed me to do. The legal example that Ryan and I like to mention is the concept of limited liability company. Limited liability is a pervasive concept in law. And when you take it as one end of the scale and you flip it, you get maximum accountability. From limited liability to maximum accountability. Now, again, those are two extremes. But what if we started asking questions like, could you earn limited liability from maximum accountability? Could your limited liability be contingent on accounting for your impacts? And when you think about the current legislation coming from the EU, Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, that I work with a lot, that asks you to report on your ESG impacts. Could there be another layer to it and say, if you don't report, you underreport, you misrepresent, your limited liability will be reduced?
Very interesting. Did you have anything you wanted to add, Ryan?
Everything Jeanette added is really brilliant and part of this process that we bring people through, because it is a process, right? The course or the learning journey is the first step in even enabling individuals or organizations as entire functioning entities to think about how they're going to navigate the transition. Because really, if I can put that in a certain way, is that certain things have to be discontinued in order for human life to continue, right? So certain things have to shift. And if we're still creating solutions from the source of where the problem lies, for example, the financialization of nature, then we're not going to be able to navigate that transition, because our solutions are only coming from one specific place that's emerging from the crisis itself. As Bayo Akomolafe says, the way we're responding to the crisis is a part of the crisis. So in order to actually enable businesses to thrive in the next stage of where things are moving across this liminal space, they have to prepare with resilience and adaptability about how to navigate this middle ground, right? We're basically in the middle of a river. We've kind of left the shore of this side, and we know we can't really go back there. Some people are trying to cling and trying to continue to go back, but we can't go back. You know, we can't reverse anything that we've done. Hence the understanding of adaptability. What we have to do is to actively figure out ways to navigate what is coming down the pipe, so that we can move into the next state of where businesses are going to thrive in harmony with life rather than creating harm with life. So to make that jump, and if businesses want to actually have a longevity beyond a few years or whatever the short-term, medium-term, long-term vision is of these certain businesses, we have to think in a capacity that projects us out into that future state and then works backwards. And that needs an agility of the mind, that needs creativity, that needs imagination, that needs true disruption, actually disrupting the certain things that we continually think and act like disrupting our habit structures, disrupting the ways that we think about problems, disrupting the questions that we're willing to ask. Because no matter which way we're looking at it, we can't bargain with the earth, you know? We can create this reporting structure here. We can say that our product is net zero and organic here, but ultimately, if it's not, it's not. You know, so we really have to look and ask these hard questions, because not only does the organization's life depend on it, but the life of future generations for the organizations to actually interact with also depend on it. The life of species that human life is dependent upon, depend on it. So we have to really start to take into consideration all of these sort of questions and purviews and perspectives in order to truly enable business to continue to thrive and to move into a space that it's not only going to thrive individually and isolated, but it's going to thrive in a collaborative ecosystemic environment.
Fascinating. Thank you so much. I did have one more question, if that's okay, because I always like to end my episodes with a practical takeaway for people. And so my question to you will be, what is the one thing that you would like the lawyers listening to this episode to take away and use in their legal practice tomorrow?
I would say that there are ways to do things differently within the system we are set in, and that law as it's written now, it's not inherently destructive and extractive. It's the way that we use law that actually enables that destruction and extraction. So it is us and the way we think that is the problem. And that can be easily changed, right? It takes years to change law, but it could take a day to change your way of thinking. And I think that's a very powerful takeaway.
The hearing.
What struck me was how powerful simply changing perspective could be. Stepping outside of the normal way of thinking is essential for lawyers providing the best solutions to their clients. But using relationships as our foundation, not merely transactions, could have benefits that go a lot further than one client and one deal. What if we approached every case with the aim of putting all parties affected into a better position than they are in now? Is that a naive dream, or the start of a completely new way of being a great lawyer?
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.